Welcome to the RSP cast. This is the quick game. This is week 7, and I am Matt Waldman with Mark Schofield, my co-host, where we do nothing but basically throw slants and, quick hitches and short curl routes and the speed out. With the occasional, I guess maybe the occasional deep post thrown in. What do you think, Mark?
I mean, we look very much like the current iteration of the Philadelphia Eagles offense, which is really just relying on a lot of quick game stuff. And then every once in a while, they'll call that little, four verticals with a running back seam route out of the backfield for Miles Sanders. Like, that's what we're looking like right now. And it works at times. And other times it's a little dicey, but that's more a matter of the help around the talent, which I guess in this case makes me Alshon Jeffrey running out of bounds on a perfectly thrown vertical route with nothing but grass in front of me. But it happens.
Yeah. I mean, if that's the case, then I must be Miles Sanders taking it to the corner store a little too often. So, yeah, but we can beat Anthony Barr on a rub route. So that'll work. So for those of you not familiar with a quick game, Mark and I have a list of questions that we're going to try and go through. We each give each other a minute to respond. If we call for a timeout before we answer the question, we get a full 3 minutes to talk about it, and we go through as many questions as we can. So, Mark, you want to get this thing started?
I am going to get it started because we are switching it up a little bit this week because we got a request from listeners. We had put out a call for perhaps an extra question, non-football related, but somebody asked, maybe it'd be interesting this week if I ask the questions and Matt goes first and I get a chance to bounce them off of him. So we're going to switch it up and I'll kick things off with this. And this is actually a question that was submitted to me on Twitter from David Tang, who was just asking generally, and I thought it'd be great to get Matt and I to both chime in on it. And the question is basically this: do quarterbacks matter less than we think in the National Football League?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think he kind of followed it up saying that, if a guy's struggling, why not just insert another guy in there, and be able to let them play. And I think that the issue is that they matter less, I think, from the standpoint of that if you get a system to work around the correct type of quarterback, that matches that system, I think that you can get strong play out of that, where you don't necessarily have to look for the 6'5" power armed, high book intelligence type of player. You can get guys who have, different forms of what you would call intelligence, who also, play the game differently than that, that statuesque Johnny Unitas type of play. So I think, though, that the problem is that you still need to have rapport. You still need to be able to have people on the same page, which involves, a lot of reps, a lot of time. And while occasionally you can surprise a team with a backup and get good play where a defense isn't really familiar with the player, over the long term, I think switching players back and forth really hurts the rapport of the game, in terms of what the offenses do.
Yeah, very good answer, Mr. Waldman, to sort of kick things off there with 1 second to spare. Tremendously well done. In looking at this question, I think at the outset, I certainly hope they don't matter less, because as somebody that spends the bulk of his time covering the quarterback position, I'd like to think that it matters some. But I think it's interesting because we have seen quarterbacks sort of come into the league and have success early, and Gardner Minshew is one example just this year where you might not be expecting it. But there's so much that goes into just playing the position that's more than just making throws and making reads and being athletic, sort of building that relationship and that rapport, like you were saying, that goes into playing this position that I think makes it tough to sort of switch, that old expression, don't change horses midstream. I think there is an element to that when it comes to playing the quarterback position. There's also, look, football coaches are risk averse people. And the idea of just making a big change like that leaves them a bit uneasy. And so because of that, they're less likely to do it. So I think the position still matters. And it's all the other stuff that we don't get a chance to really quantify that probably goes into why teams don't do this.
Yeah. And I agree. I mean, and I think that, just to your point, it's just one of those situations where, you look at a guy like Gardner Minshew and you think, you know, he's played there. There's been more use out of a six pack than there has been out of, you know, Gardner Minshew at this point. So yeah, it's hard to say over time. And I think that's the whole thing, is that it's about what happens over time, not within a span of a handful of games or even 6 to 8 games.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. Another good question, number two here. Are we casting too much blame on Jared Goff and not enough on Sean McVay?
I think so. And, you know, this is an argument that I made at Football Guys this week. And I feel like that I've probably been the Stan account on Twitter for Jared Goff. But really, the issue for me is this, is that when you look at what Jared Goff has done post-snap, when he is given progression reads, multiple progression reads, when he does have to deal with pressure that isn't a complete jailbreak of his offensive line, but he has to still avoid a difficult pressure situation. He can avoid the man, make the moves, make the accurate throws. He's able to read the field. He's able to, you know, manipulate coverage. So when I look at all of that, that's football intelligence. Post-snap, that's football intelligence. It's also football technique. So it's hard for me to think that just because Sean McVay wants to make the calls pre-snap, that Jared Goff is just completely absent of football intelligence to do that. I think people are kind of basing it more on his, you know, early beginnings, transition from the air raid to a West Coast scheme and struggling with that early on. And I don't think they're understanding that there's more to it than that. So, you know, I think it's more about his offensive line.
I think you're right that it is about the offensive line in large part. And the reason why I love this question is because it mirrors almost exactly what we were saying about Trubisky and Nagy like 2 or 3 weeks ago, when we were wondering if perhaps Nagy is holding back Trubisky's development in a sense. And I think we might be seeing some of that with Jared Goff and Sean McVay. And people loved Sean McVay and his offense last year when it was clicking. And now when they're having some struggles on the offensive line, when you're seeing, like you said, sort of jailbreak pressure, it's tougher to get a true sense of what this offense is. And with respect to Jared Goff, I'm kind of with you in the sense that there are examples of him making incredibly quick snap decisions post-snap that have nothing to do with what he's being told in the radio headset. I mean, he had a throw against the Saints where they ran a sort of Mills-type concept. He reads the coverage perfectly. It's a snap decision, and he makes the right read and the right throw in the blink of an eye. So he could do it. So I do wonder if, similar to what we were saying about Trubisky and Nagy, McVay's reliance on involving himself in the plays has held Jared Goff back.
Yeah. Good job. We're just in time. And yeah, and I think that, I mean, you just look at the Super Bowl and you look at what, you know, in terms of that. And I've kind of joked that it's like there's an MMA match and there's a stipulation that you can bring in a foreign object, and Bill Belichick's all over that. And Sean McVay's sitting there still like posing in the mirror, you know, oiling up his muscles and kind of kissing his bicep. And that's and just walks in there thinking, I'm good right where I'm at.
I mean, it's what's the phrase, adapt or die, right? So yeah, it doesn't seem like they're doing that right now.
Yeah, they're kind of withering on the vine. So
that brings us to the third question. And this one, Matt, it pains me because it brings me back to my first year actually covering the draft, pseudo-professionally, I guess we'll phrase it that way. But are Marcus Mariota and Jameis Winston's time as NFL starters done after this year?
Well, you know, if I were a troll account, I'd be saying, well, that proves to me that Brett Hundley had just as good of a chance as Mariota and Winston, because I liked Hundley, but to be honest, I liked Winston more. I liked Marcus Mariota almost as much as I liked Hundley. And Marcus Mariota had more success, obviously, than the former UCLA quarterback. You know, looking at this, I think their time is done. There may be a team that will go for them one more, I guess. But I think they're going to quickly prove that they're going to have a hole to dig out of emotionally after all of this. I think Winston's just basically playing his time out as an interception machine for a very talented passing game in terms of the receivers they have in Tampa Bay. And Mariota, I think he's going to end up somewhere else, and I think it's going to be more in a backup capacity. I feel like what happens with these players is that after getting kind of dragged through a slow development that's been up and down and mostly down, that teams are going to move on, especially with a rich quarterback class coming up.
Yeah. First of all, 2 seconds left. Very well done there. I'm going to try to be optimistic here just because, you know, it does look like this is a very good quarterback class coming out. And the next one behind it, depending on if, you know, who comes this year and who stays, might be just as good. But I do also think that when you're picked that high in the draft, there is going to be an opportunity for you to have sort of a second stab at it. You know, we're not talking about guys that were picked in the fourth round, fifth round, where it's basically one and done. And I think it was it Ryan Riddle that sort of made that case recently on Twitter where, you know, the draft position is going to determine how many options you get as a pro athlete, particularly in the NFL. And so I think there will be a situation, a home for these teams, these guys next year. I mean, I'll just throw it out there. People have already said the Marcus Mariota to New England stuff already, and it's just been less than 24 hours since Tannehill has gotten that gig. So I'm sure these guys will get an opportunity. The fear is, are they ruined now? And I know you wrote a great piece about ruining quarterbacks. Are we there with these guys? We might be, and that's probably the bigger thing. I don't think they're done. I think they'll get another chance, but they might be just too much damaged goods at this point.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
So we'll move to the wide receiver position, putting us on very familiar territory for Mr. Waldman, as he does such a great job breaking down wide receivers. And the question is this. If you could pick any wide receiver as a foundation for your team and know he would stay healthy, and I know why he snuck this one in, and legal, who do you take?
I would say Tyreek Hill. And I think it's, you know, it's not necessarily because I think he's the best wide receiver in the NFL. I mean, I honestly think if I was going to take the most well-rounded wide receiver in the NFL, it would be Chris Godwin. Would be one of the guys that I'd want because he's young and he has a great all-around game. But I want a player who's going to be able to put the fear of God in defenses and to be able to wreck coverage in a way that it'll help other players. Because I think I can find players who can at least approximate a Chris Godwin's of the world enough that I can find those guys at a lower price. But I don't think I'm going to find many people like Tyreek Hill and what he can do in the run game and the short passing game, and as well as being able to just win the ball as a rebounder. He's quickly becoming, I don't say this lightly, but he's starting to approach the neighborhood and buy a house down the street from where Steve Smith's was set up in the NFL. And I think that the fact that he's even like being able to sniff around that street tells me a lot that I would like to have him on my team.
That's a very good answer. And I came in to this expected to go the Julio Jones route. And I was going to make a case for Julio because, look, he's just a freak and there's so much that he can do for an offense. But I think the points you made about Tyreek Hill have made me sort of switch here on the fly, because when you look at the evolution of the game right now and how teams are approaching offensive football and how it's so matchup-based, but it's matchup-based in the sense that you're not just putting a guy out there and say, look, go beat this guy. You're moving people around. You're creating mismatches and then exploiting them. Tyreek Hill is the kind of player that you can do so many different things with schematically. You can use him as a decoy in a sense. Like, for example, that sort of, you know, running back seam route out of the backfield to Miles Sanders that we've seen so many different teams. It stems from an opening night a couple years ago, Kansas City at New England, where you had Tyreek Hill in jet motion and everybody on the Patriots flipped out of the secondary because they were so worried about the jet sweep that Kareem Hunt was wide open on a seam route out of the backfield. And so the things that he can do for your offense, not just with the ball in his hands, are so important.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Definitely.
Yeah, and again, that's why you snuck in the "and legal" for that question. Let's move on. Let's play professors for a moment, Matt. How do you teach people to read coverage? Pointers, please.
Yeah, and this question is really intended for Mark, but I'm going to go ahead and take a time out on this one so that I can give at least my layman's, you know, answer here, and then we can get the real professional be able to give us the give us the answer.
But I don't know about that.
Yeah, but for me, it's less about whether it's cover three or cover one or quarters or, you know, rat or, you know, buzz or whatever, you know, the different terminology you can have for coverage. To me, one of the things for me is just that I try and scan things. I look at things geometrically in terms of triangles. And the way I look at that is that I try and study, you know, when I'm looking at wide receivers or I'm looking at the position, the alignments of where my receivers are, I'm trying to look at where the cornerback, linebacker, safety trio are in relation to those receivers, so that I can, and the shading of those players over the receivers and the depth of those players to help me determine, you know, where zone or man might be in specific spaces. So for me, there's part of it that I look at that in terms of pre-snap and immediately post-snap, and sometimes, or maybe early pre-snap and late pre-snap, because you start to see movement there where the coverage starts to reveal the disguise that it was, or to basically get rid of the disguise that it had. So those are the things, some of the things that I look at, you know, based on looking at reading books, things like The Complete Wide Receiver from Jay Norvell, who used to coach guys like Marvin Harrison and Reggie Wayne and, you know, the Oklahoma receivers before Marquise Brown. You know, so there's things like that, looking at those, that trio of defenders. I also look, you know, inside shade is kind of more, you know, where defenders lined up a little bit more to the inside of the receiver, tends to be more of a man-to-man type of route. Outside shade tends to be more of a zone type of route. I look for, you know, other things that I look for in terms of, you know, reading the field is how, where the defender is at the end of the quarterback's drop. You know, is his back to the receiver? Is he turned towards the sideline? Is he turned towards the middle of the field? Where's the receiver in relation to that? And knowing what the, you know, what the route is supposed to be, also can determine whether or not the quarterback should throw the ball. And those are concepts that you can get from, like, from headset to helmet, the R4 system from Dubmatics. And those are things that, you know, while being able to talk about all the different coverages that are available and understanding those coverages is certainly helpful, I think you can also learn a lot just from, you know, again, the timing of where the ball's supposed to come out, what the routes are supposed to be, and where the defenders are in relation to that, and how the quarterback should be reading that to be able to make the play or not. And I think it helps you determine things like who's daring versus who's by the book. You know, I think when you and I looked at Patrick Mahomes on our YouTube film room and we loved him so much is because he didn't necessarily go by the book all the time by what the coverage dictated, but there was logic behind some of his plays that were, that some people would have considered reckless, but actually were much more bold strokes and intelligent strokes in his game.
Very well said. I loved everything you put in there, Matt. And I'm going to take a time out too, because I'm kind of excited to dive into this one. And, you know, for me, I still approach it like I did when I was under center, because the mindset that I learned as I was playing the position is so seared into my brain that when I sit down and watch a play, I still take, you know, pen and paper, notes by hand, and I'd say probably 70 to 80% of the stuff that I write down comes from before the ball is snapped, because my eyes immediately go first to the safeties. Where are they? Where are they aligned? You know, the offensive formation might dictate where safeties might be aligned, but do I see two deep? Do I see one deep? If I see one deep, is he middle of the field? Is he over the ball? Is he shaded to trips or some other reason formation wise in the offense and has him shaded for some reason? So that's where my eyes go first, because obviously if you get, once the play begins, a safety in the middle of the field, that's going to be some kind of single high, cover one, cover three, and then, you know, the variations, robber, buzz, rat, and things like that that you might see. If you still get too deep, it's obviously a member of the cover two family, cover two, cover four, cover six. So I first go to the safeties, then my eyes come to the corners on the boundaries. Where are their feet? That's what I look at. I don't look at so much as what they're doing cushion wise or even alignment wise. I want to see their feet. If their feet are sort of parallel to the line of scrimmage, that tells me man. That tells me some kind of man coverage. Now, it could also be some sort of combination where you're getting sort of that Seattle cover three where those guys are basically playing man on the outside, or some combo coverage where it might be mag everywhere, man everywhere he goes on the outside. But I want to see their feet, because if their feet are more staggered towards the middle of the field, that's telling me we're going to get a zone turn from them. So they're going to drop into some sort of zone type coverage. And so those were, that's where my eyes go first. Then in the pre-snap phase, like you said, we might see some rotation or some movement from these guys. And how is that fitted into the puzzle that's in front of me? If I see two high safeties and then I see one of those guys start to creep down a little bit, now I'm thinking they're spinning this into some sort of, like you said, robber or buzz or rat, or maybe they're just rolling from cover two to a cover one look and he's going to come cover somebody down. Or is it going to be a potential blitz situation? And if so, is he capping a defender? Is he, say, over the slot receiver, and now that slot corner is going to blitz? And so that's stuff that I look for. If there's motion, how does the defense respond? And I talk so much about how the Patriots and other teams use motion to give the quarterback that indicator, because that's where I'm trying to put my head right now. Put my head into that quarterback's brain, and what is he seeing? And then in terms of once the play begins, in terms of deciphering what the defense is doing, again, look at where the safeties are when the ball is snapped. If you've got one in the middle of the field, you can be pretty certain it's some sort of cover one, cover three, you know, single high scheme. If you've got two, that is probably one of those middle of the field open, cover two, cover four, cover six type looks. So that's when in the post-snap phase, my eyes again go from safeties to corners, what are the corners doing? So that's how I construct it, like I'm still sort of playing the position and doing what the quarterback's likely doing on the field.
Yeah, absolutely love that. And it's just, and I love how you group together the different coverage families based on what you're seeing. So that's
awesome.
Yeah,
and it's because in so many playbooks now, college, high school, pro levels, so many routes are just middle field open, middle field closed reads. And, you know, I'll pull up the Eagles playbook from last year and it's got middle field open, you're doing this, middle field closed, you're doing that. I mean, that's how teams are doing it. So it's those bunching up by families. The one thing I will say, if you really want to get into this stuff, the books that Matt was just talking about are great. The Make Defense Great Again podcast from Coach Vass. I mean, he had like a 3-hour thing on cover seven, which I've listened to like three times right now. Also, Matt Bowen in 2014, when he was a Bleacher Report, wrote a series, football 101 series they were doing on all the basic coverage families. And I swear, Bleacher Report is probably wondering, who is this guy that keeps reading these articles like every day from 2014? It's me. Like, I will go back to those, but I'm writing something right now about Sam Darnold's game against Dallas. And I've got one of those pieces open in a tab because I'm still referencing it. So even though I've been doing this stuff for years, both playing and now writing, I still have that stuff in front of me. So those are great resources too.
It's funny you mentioned that because Ryan Riddle is a player, is a former Bleacher Report writer who I reference his work every year in the RSP and in my site all the time about that draft capital that you just talked about, which is his great article. And I'm sure they're wondering the same thing.
So look, good work stands the test of time. And those are pieces and series that do that. So speaking of good work that stands the test of time, hopefully this podcast fits into that category. We'll move to our next question. Matt, which team is impressing you the most in the NFL right now?
Wow. You know, that's, I think probably the team that is impressing me the most. I'll say this offensively. I'm really impressed with the Baltimore Ravens. And even though they've had their struggles a little bit recently against better defenses, I love how they incorporate the run game and the pass game together because, you know, Lamar Jackson is a really fun young quarterback and he has a lot of excellent skills, but I'd say he's still somewhat of a system quarterback right now. If you put a good system around him, he's going to thrive. I think he's going to grow beyond that at some point. But he's a player that still has some limitations outside the hash or outside the numbers as a thrower. You know, but this team has really done a great job of integrating what he does well into the offense and making this offense a physical unit that also creates a lot of variety in terms of what it does. So, you know, that's a team that I'm pretty impressed with.
Impressive answer there. A team you're impressed with, Baltimore Ravens. I'm going to go, I'll split it up sort of this way. Defensively, I think it's New England. I know, look, last week San Francisco has played themselves into sort of the mix of perhaps the best defense in the game. But, you know, watching the Patriots sort of week in, week out, playing and play out, I've been so impressed with what they can do. They're so deep at all three levels on the defense. And Stephon Gilmore, for my money, he's the best corner in the game right now. And so defensively, it's the Patriots. Offensively, I'll go with the team I just mentioned, San Francisco. And it's weird because you know, people are talking to, similar to the McVay stuff from a year ago, like how revolutionary and how fantastic Kyle Shanahan is. But it's a great example of how a lot of this stuff isn't really new. You know, you pull up his playbook, you pull up Bill Walsh's playbook from 1985. It's the same stuff. You know, it's packaged differently. But what's interesting about Shanahan is he's doing it out of this 21 personnel package, which they run more than anybody, you know, with a fullback. Now the fullback's hurt, but still, it's, it looks revolutionary because it's just stuff we saw, gosh, 40 years ago. And so I've been impressed with what they've done. I've been impressed with how he's stringing together plays as a play caller. So I say the Niners offense.
Yeah, I love it. And they're beating people up. They're playing physical brand of football, which is just always fun.
Let's flip this, Matt. Team you've been disappointed in the most.
Well, you know,
do you want to take a timeout and talk about the factory of sadness? Go ahead.
I won't take a timeout. I don't think I need to go that far into it. Certainly the Browns are on that list because, you know, you look at the fact that, you know, that Baker Mayfield has not been able to throw pinpoint accurate passes in the timing game. That's beyond, you know, just three step drops and or short drops and a quick, you know, RPO type of look or one, you know, a manufactured one read type of manipulation type of deal. When he has to actually throw, I don't know, deep outs and comebacks and curl routes and deeper slants, he throws the ball behind receivers when he's pressured and he has to make multiple reads. That's not working out so well. The offensive line certainly hasn't been very good, hasn't been great, but it hasn't been the jailbreak situation like it was for, as it has been for Jared Goff. So, you know, that's disappointing. I'm disappointed that Sean McVay has not adjusted his offense, you know, to what's been exposed, and he's been very stubborn about it. So I think that, you know, those two teams I'm kind of disappointed in. I've been disappointed a little bit in the Atlanta Falcons, only because this defense, even though they've had some injuries, the linebacking core continues to be a bunch of athletes who don't do a great job of being able to create it. You know, maintain angles on ball carriers in the open field, in the middle of the field. They don't tackle extremely well. And then in addition to that, the offensive line, you know, I was disappointed only because of my expectations were too high for a new unit.
Yeah, I think those are all very good answers. I'm going to crush Atlanta in a few minutes. So I'm going to set that team aside. Might even take a timeout for that one just to talk about one play. Boy. But I'll go with the Rams. I think the Browns are disappointed, but I think part of the disappointment stems from manufactured hype on the outside. I think people really sort of bought in. And I'm also going to talk about this in a few minutes. Like I said, I did my homework for this show. But I'll talk about the Rams just because the McVay and his sort of inability to sort of adapt, I think we've covered that. I think their struggles on the offensive line have really led to a lot of what Goff is dealing with. I mean, when you're sort of going up against a quick offense, a quick defensive line like San Francisco, and you insist on pulling guards on play action designs, you're going to get sacks. And that's what we saw last week in that game against San Francisco. So their sort of stagnation offensively from a conceptual standpoint through an execution standpoint has been really disappointing. And they've really made it tougher on their defense. Now they get the big trade with Ramsey. We'll see how that works. But yeah, I think it's the Rams. They've been the most disappointing team.
Awesome answer. And with a few seconds to spare, and I love the idea that, you know, what you're talking about, even in terms of conceptually what they're doing with that offensive line, doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense, especially going up against some of the teams they've been playing. So, but we'll see. There's still time. There's still time. All right. Going back to the professorial mode, Matt, some tips for evaluating offensive line play.
Yeah. I mean, this is one that I'm still trying, you know, working on and learning, you know, and I feel much more like a student than I do a professor in this one. But I think for me, some of the things that you want to look at is I think that to start with is there cohesion in terms of that these guys are making their assignments, you know, are, you know, especially say on blitz pickup or where, you know, the teams make some sort of line adjustment. Is there a guy coming through that shouldn't be coming through? Do you see linemen who are looking around at each other as a defender runs through, you know, I mean, you're trying to look, you want to make sure that they are up to date with their protections and that everyone's on the same page there. That's part of it for me. I think that, you know, is the line consistently getting a push and resetting the line of scrimmage in front of that line? That's another area that you want to see on a consistent basis. Are most of them being able to do that, especially on the play side in terms of where you're trying to, you know, where that run play is supposed to go? You know, I think that for me, you know, when I look at offensive lines, I want to see really strong center play more than tackle play. To me, actually, center and guard play has to be really strong.
Very good insight there. And I love the stuff about the interior line. When it comes to evaluating O-line play, I'd say, first off, don't listen to me about it, because, again, I'm still learning it. And there are still times where I'm like, is this duo? Is this zone? Like, I don't know what I'm looking at here. There are great resources like Brandon Thorne. On Twitter, for example, is a fantastic offensive line resource. I think one thing you do sort of want to try to do is, what are they being asked to do on a given play, and are they doing that job? So if it's, you know, a zone scheme, like, how's their footwork? Are they moving in fluidity? Are they moving in unison? Or is there a breakdown on up front where you're letting some gaps be created? You know, if it's gap power type run plays, like, are they sort of fire it out? Are they getting that push up front, like you mentioned, Matt? And on pass protection, like, obviously the big thing is, are they getting beat? You know, and we can talk about sort of the way the protection gets fanned and different styles of pass pro, but really just, are guys getting beat? If they are, is it a failure in execution or a failure in technique? You know, it can be both on the same play, but is their footwork bad? Are they slow? Are they missing on their punch? Or are they doing the wrong thing? And so a lot of it is sort of study, but yeah, offensive line is really tough to figure out.
Yeah, it is. And it's one of those things that I think that even when you have good offensive linemen who come to a new team, are they going to play well together? And that's a whole other issue, which is why, you know, when we do a lot of previews, why the preview to the season doesn't always match up to the reality of the season.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Speaking of previews not matching up to reality, Matt, you get a chance to reform one of these quarterbacks. Which one do you take and why? And the choices are Baker Mayfield, the aforementioned Marcus Mariota or Jameis Winston, or Josh Rosen. Which one are you rolling with?
I'm going with Rosen. And I think it's mainly because, you know, I don't think he's been ruined yet. And I know that sounds kind of crazy to say, but there hasn't been any high expectations for him since a year and a half ago. And even like midway through the year, people were basically abandoning ship because of how bad the offensive line was in Arizona. And then they dumped him. So, you know, for me, Rosen also was the most complete quarterback of the quartet in terms of what he could do, play action, what he can do middle of the field, reading coverage, manipulating coverage. And I think that he's a guy that's just kind of gotten a raw deal, but kind of has been under the surface now, is like, yeah, nobody expects as much from him as they did of these other three guys. And I think these other three guys are fighting those expectations and always had certain issues that never really got better. And it's kind of, teams kind of figured out them out and sapped their confidence. Whereas I think if you can put Rosen in a better system and better situation, you might be able to get more out of him, and his confidence is still probably going to be high enough.
Very good answer. And I'm going to just piggyback off that here and say it's Rosen for a lot of the reasons that you just said, Matt. But more than anything else, look, I don't want to be wrong. I mean, Rosen was my top quarterback in that class. And right now, look, we're breaking some news here in the RSP cast, because it was just announced Rosen's going to be benched this week. So it's the Ryan Fitzpatrick show. And, you know, it's a tough situation for him down in Miami. It's been a tough situation for him in Arizona. But I do think he's a very complete quarterback. I loved where he was both mentally and physically. I loved his footwork in the pocket. I loved his mind in the pocket as well. And so I think there's still a good quarterback in there. And the other guys, I think Mayfield's going to be okay. The other two, I think, probably are ruined. So I'll go with Rosen.
Yeah. And you have 20 seconds to spare, so I'm just going to ask this question. Do you think they benched Rosen because they've given him just enough games to where now the team's starting to get some continuity and the tank for Tua thing might not work out very well? And it's kind of like the same reason why Kenyon Drake doesn't seem to be getting the love that he deserved. No,
I mean, there could be some truth to that. I mean, you're starting to look good. Oh, we can't have that. Oh, so let's roll Ryan Fitzpatrick out there. So let's keep Ted Kennedy-Drake stapled to the bench next to me because – and I'm sure we'll talk about the quarterbacks, but Tua does look good. I mean, we'll say that. He does look good.
Yeah. Yeah, he really does.
Speaking of guys that look good, this is just some insight into how we do this show. Matt always sends over the questions like, you know, the night before, morning of. I get a chance to look at them, start to formulate my thoughts, do a little bit of prep. This question is the hardest one, I think, this week. Travis Kelce or Kittle?
This one pains me.
Yeah.
This one pains me big time.
Yeah. And I want to say, I want to punt on this one. I really do.
Yeah. I have a twinge of guilt because I'm going to go with George Kittle. Okay. Because I loved Travis Kelce pre-draft, and he is such a fantastic receiver, and he is a good blocker. He's terrific after the catch, strong guy, go up and win the ball. And even as I've been saying all these things, I'm wondering if I'm crazy for saying George Kittle. But I think that Kittle's ability to transition upfield is so fantastic. He's a better blocker than Kelce. And he's someone that can just handle the volume, and they use him in just as many different ways as the Chiefs use Kelce. And I think that if they wanted to put Kittle in the Chiefs offense, you would get the same results that you would get with Kelce. I think you'd get similar results with Kelce in the Chief in the 49ers offense, but I think Kittle would be just a little bit better. And so that's why I'm going with Kittle, as much as I hate to do so.
I love that you sort of brought that sort of trade the two situations element into it, because I think it really crystallizes the decision here. I mean, I think I was going to try to cop out and say, well, it depends on what kind of offense I'm running, because if I'm asking my tight end to be in line, it's Kittle. If I'm going to move around more, it's Kelce. But I think you're right that, you know, you drop Kelce into this Niners offense and ask him to do what Kittle's asked to do, and you're going to see production. He's going to be successful, but it's not going to be what Kittle's doing. But Kittle in that Andy Reid offense, you can move him around and you can have the same sort of level of play that you're seeing from him. And so I think that kind of crystallizes the decision for me. I love both of these guys, but I do think it is Kittle. And that seems weird to say. It seems weird to say.
Yeah. But it really does.
It just makes it the case that, look, these Iowa tight ends, I don't know what Kirk Ferentz and everybody teaching them, but they're doing good work, because now Hawkinson seems to be in, you know, Fant, they seem to be piecing together too. So
what color do they paint the tight end room? Because no, you know, obviously the tight end room color pink, right?
That's the full dark on black, right? It's not going to be the business pink. Certainly not. Especially the way these guys can block and get after it. Speaking of getting after it, we got a trade, some trade news. We're seeing more trades in the league now, but we finally get the big one, Jalen Ramsey on the move to go out west to the Los Angeles Rams. And now, Matt, do you think the Rams won this trade? Do you think Jacksonville won this trade? Does a team have an advantage here, or is it just both sides won?
I think both sides won, though. You know, there are certainly folks who know a lot more and keep up with a lot more about the value of first round picks more than I do. But I think that the Jaguars got enough that they're not taking several steps back. I think they're going to be able to, you know, they're going to be able to maintain where, you know, kind of the trajectory that they're heading. I think the Rams get a player who's going to be able to play a variety. I don't think this is like a Nnamdi Asamoah type of situation where Asamoah was, be able to play a certain type of coverage, but then when you move them, you know, you move them away from that and make them play press instead of off, that he's going to struggle. I think Ramsey can give you a variety of different coverage skills that will help, and I think Wade Phillips is going to figure out a way to use him in a way that will work, that will work out well. I don't think Wade Phillips is that inflexible, even though he's had his kind of system for a while. So I think it's an upgrade to this team, and I think that you get more from him as both a tackler and a coverage player than what you got from either Peters, or even when you get what you get from Aqib Talib as a pair of corners. So I think this helps the Rams.
Yeah, I think this is one of those that kind of helps both teams in a sense. I think both teams right now could feel that they got the best they were going to get out of this deal. And so from the Rams' perspective, like you said, look, he brings an element to that secondary, maybe even an element to that team right now, which they need, which is a little bit of a perhaps a jolt of energy or a kick to the pants, however you want to phrase it, because you're coming out of a Super Bowl loss. We just got done crushing them, saying they were the most disappointing team in the NFL. Now you get Jalen Ramsey, perhaps the game's sort of best trash talker and someone that's going to invigorate that defense a bit. And Wade Phillips gets a nice piece to work with in that secondary. So I think that certainly helps them. But look, Jacksonville, you're with a player that doesn't want to play for you anymore, doesn't want to be there. Teams know you're stuck behind, you know, a rock and a hard place here, but they were still able to get some good value in return. So I think, you know, kudos to them for getting what they could for it. So I think it's a win-win, but obviously it helps the Rams in the short term more than it does Jacksonville.
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
Speaking of trades, we got another one. And it's also a defensive back situation, and it involves a team we were just sort of mentioning, albeit in a little bit of a different way. But Marcus Peters goes to Baltimore, and our mutual friend Doug Farrar says he doesn't quite see the fit. Matt, do you agree with Doug?
I mean, I do, because Doug says that it's, you know, that the Ravens play a type of defense where Peters isn't really a system guy. He's more of an improvisational player, and that doesn't really fit what Baltimore has done. But then I think about it, and the counter argument I can think of without getting too technical is that, you know, Humphrey, it seems to be an up and comer as a cornerback. Peter seems to be a guy that you probably need to have someone help out on his side. And who better to do that than Thomas? You know, when you have a safety right. like Thomas, who still has, you know, excellent range, why not? Maybe you shade things a little bit more there and you say, well, we'll let Humphrey, you know, do the best that he can here. But we might be able to get some big plays out of Peters if he has the comfort of maybe Thomas kind of lurking in the area. So I could see where maybe they might make some adjustments there. And I think Baltimore is the type of team that is willing to make certain types of adjustments to accommodate the talent that they get. So the idea of fixing Marcus Peters, I don't necessarily agree that they're going to be able to do that, but maybe tweaking their defense to make Marcus Peters shine is something that I would see Baltimore giving a shot.
Very good answer. 5 seconds to spare. And I think that's where I come down on this. I understand Doug's points about sort of the schematic elements to the Baltimore defense and what they do and how Peters might not be the best fit for that given the freelance that he does do. But at the same time, the Baltimore Ravens tend to be an organization that's a bit more forward thinking, and they seem more willing to make the scheme work with the players they have in the sense that they're not going to force guys to do what they can't do. They're going to take guys and what they can do. That's what we're going to do. And you talk about it on the offensive side of the ball with how they've been handling Lamar Jackson. I think they'll find a way to sort of tweak what they do in the secondary to the skill set of the players that they now have. And so I think because of that, they'll find a way to make the fit work rather than forcing Marcus Peters to become something that he's not.
Yeah. Totally, totally, totally. Nice answer. All right, a lot of time to spare, too.
Yeah. Well, you know, like I said, I practiced that one because I was worried because I don't want to disagree with Doug because, I mean, he's a published author now. I mean, come on.
That's right. And they're still not on the discount bookshelves.
No. He's been crushing it. So speaking of a team that I don't want to say is crushing it, but perhaps might be saving somebody's job, the Denver Broncos. Are they going to end up saving John Elway's job here?
Man, did Skeletor really die in He-Man ever?
I think there you go. There's your answer, kids.
Yeah, I don't think he did. So I think that they are going to save it as disappointed as I am to say as a Browns fan. But I would say that they are. I mean, you look at the run game, they're blending Philip Lindsay and Royce Freeman together very well because Lindsay has great feet, great vision, excellent burst and speed, but he's not a power guy. They're always willing to run it up in there. And then you have Freeman, who has good feet, good vision, and a lot of power, but he doesn't have breakaway speed. And they're finding ways to meld those two to get a really good running attack. Cortland Sutton's playing very well. I mean, I still quibble over how he uses his hands as a receiver, and I still think he's a roller coaster in terms of every time the ball basically gets thrown to him, but he's making the plays. Emmanuel Sanders is healthy. I mean, Flacco's playing well enough, and this defense, I think, is only going to get better. So, yeah, I think they're on the verge of saving John Elway's job.
Yeah, I agree with everything you just said there, Matt. And let's be honest, this game Thursday night seems a little bit different than it did when we looked at it, say, a couple of weeks ago, looking at the schedule down the road, because now you're Kansas City, you're coming off two losses, you know, two losses at home. Obviously to teams that, you know, are in the playoff mix and, you know, Indianapolis and Houston, but this game looks a little bit different. You have to go on the road, short week to Denver, notoriously tough place to play. We could be talking about, you know, the 3-4 Broncos and the 4-3 Chiefs this time Friday. And I know that still seems a little bit outlandish, but short weeks, Thursday night games, strange things do happen. We saw the Giants play New England tough, you know, last week. So, yeah, I think they're in the process of saving Elway's job. The offense seems to be playing better. Flacco's all right now. The defense is getting better. Yeah, they're going to turn around for him, it seems like.
I agree, and I think you're absolutely right about how the division could wind up here, because the Chiefs are still just kind of, you know, injuries and defensive play hasn't been great. So this is definitely Denver's opportunity to get right back into it.
Yeah, and Kansas City's defense is bad right now. We can be honest. We're all friends here. It's bad. But speaking of a bad defense, the Atlanta Falcons, Matt. Are they on the verge of costing Dan Quinn his job? Or I'll tweak this question. Is Dan Quinn on the verge of costing himself his job?
Oh, yeah. This team, listen, I mean, it's always funny to me how head coaches are known for a specialty. And more often than not, it's that specialty that they have to delegate away, or that they have to try and run when they should be delegating it. That tends to be their ultimate failure for being a head coach. You know, whether it's Brian Billick, the great offensive mind for the Baltimore Ravens. I just laugh when I think putting those two words together, even though he was fantastic in Minnesota. But of course, he had that great talent too. But you look at that, and that's the type of situation that occurs here. And the Falcons, I mean, other than Grady Jarrett, who's a one-man wrecking crew as much as he can be, you know, this pass rush is okay, but it's not fantastic. The back seven is just horrible. Some of it has to do with injury, but then you look at guys like Desmond Trufant, who's a bit more like a Marcus Peters. He's kind of an improviser. He doesn't play very well by the book. His techniques are really kind of questionable, and he gets away with some of it some of the time, but he'd also cost them big plays. They have a young secondary in addition to that. And the linebacking core, I know that people love Deion Jones' athletic ability, but he's always been an undisciplined player and not a great diagnostic player, other than maybe being able to run sideline to sideline. You know, he has flashes of greatness, but this team has really let down Quinn in terms of what it's done. Defensively and offensively, Dirk Cutter's pretty darn predictable, and you can see how predictable that he's been. And I think that that was not necessarily the greatest choice for Atlanta.
Yeah. And I think I'll piggyback off your point about Dan Quinn. I thought about using the timeout here, but I don't need that much time to say what I need to say here about this defense, because last week against Arizona, there was a 1st-and-10 play, okay, where they ran one of the coverages with the middle of the field open. You had two deep safeties. And Kyler Murray just had to throw a simple check down to Johnson out of the backfield. And I'm holding up, so everybody watching on News Channel 8, a screenshot of the ball in the air and Johnson settling in around the 50-yard line. And Matt, there isn't a defender within 30 yards of him. It's just a simple check down on 1st-and-10. It's not like it's 4th-and-30. It's 1st-and-10. And they can't cover a running back out of the backfield. And I'm not saying they're giving him like 5 yards of cushion. There's literally nobody within 30 yards of this guy. Like, you're a bad defense right now. Everybody.
They're back in Atlanta.
Seriously, they didn't get on the plane. And look, everybody like loves the dots. I'm not a big fan of the dots, whatever. The dots where they show the gifts of the plays with the circles and stuff like that. Yeah. But after every Atlanta game, there's a gif of a dots running around on the electric football table. And again, nobody's being covered. There's just guys running wide open. So it's time. He's got to go. You're a defensive guy. You can't cover anybody. I could get open against the secondary right now. So it's done. Let's go. Arizona. Atlanta, you're bad.
And to give a contrast, watch how the Panthers played the Cardinals. And there's a lot of similar things that the Panthers did that the Falcons did. The Panthers just did it well.
And Atlanta can't do anything well. I mean, Matt Ryan's playing okay, but you're just bad. He's bad.
Yeah.
Speaking of bad, we love talking about the NFL, as you can tell from this show. But every Sunday night, Monday morning, Tuesday morning, whatever, it seems like the topic of conversation on Twitter is the officiating. It's also bad right now, and the league's trying to fix it. Doesn't seem like it's working. Matt, Roger Goodell calls you up tomorrow and says, here's $50 million to fix my product. What do you spend it on? How are you fixing the officiating in the NFL?
Well, one is you start from the top down. So I'm hoping that we can fire Roger Goodell and be able to get
just hand the money back. Here you go. This is your
second. And get a leader who is not over officious in every facet of his administration of the league, because I think that trickles down. I mean, I think the attitude of the league since Goodell has been in office has been over officious, you know, and taking on things that they shouldn't take on. I think that the NFL has done that, and that has trickled down to how they officiate. But the biggest issue is you've got to get full-time officials. You've got to have a training program that's going to be that these guys are full-time. Maybe see if you can make agreements with with other leagues that are out there, and be able to have a training program where these guys can work their way up through some of these leagues into the NFL. Something where that there's some sort of quality oversight system. I'm sure there is one now, but I'm sure it's just as I'm sure it could be ramped up a lot better than what it is if you've got a bunch of part-time people doing their job. And it's not to denigrate that these guys don't put in the effort, and that these guys, it's just that when basically no matter what they say they want to do, no matter what they're doing right now, it's not their number one priority, because it's not their primary job. And until it is their primary job, you've got a league where everyone else is a professional and it's their primary job. Why would you not put the people who are enforcing the rules of the game in that same role? Right now it's just basically, to me, what I see is a bunch of rich old dudes with, who have the cachet to say that they're on an NFL team telling young players what to do. And then they go back into their boardroom or their law office and brag about it. And some of them are really good at what they do. But again, it's got to be about the prioritization.
Yeah, I think the full-time NFL officials has to happen. That has to be step one. And I think to sort of take it a little bit bigger picture, to sort of, again, picking off what you were saying, Matt, was the league needs a true minor league system of some kind. For years we've been relying on the college game to sort of generate and develop prospects. And that's worked in some sense, but it hasn't worked other positions, although maybe the quarterback issue is changing a little bit. But I think whether it's the XFL or the AAF or whatever league, tries again to become sort of a competitor to the NFL, that eventually needs to be folded under the umbrella and become sort of a minor league system, because it allows you to develop everything you need to develop about the game. Whether it's scouted, whether it's players such as the quarterback position, or whether it's officials, like, make them full time. And now you have sort of a developmental program at all levels, coaching ranks, everything. You get young coaches that maybe are deserving of a shot at an NFL gig. They can be coaches there. So I think having a true minor league system is going to be critical to fixing this going forward.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I totally agree.
Won't happen though, but we can dream. I know. Look, you and I, we've talked about this before, on the phone and elsewhere. Like, we need a minor league system and it's never going to happen. But we can continue to dream. Speaking of dreaming, a lot of teams are thinking about fixing their franchises right now because they maybe haven't won a game yet. And Matt, you do a ton of the scouting world. You got some great shows that you're doing. You've been watching a ton of players, not just skill position players now, so you can branch out a bit. Your favorite prospect you've watched so far?
Yeah, and I've talked about him on Ross Tucker, and I've talked about him with Russ Landy last week, but I can't emphasize it enough if you haven't caught those shows. It's safety Grant Delpit out of LSU. I'm totally smitten with his game. He reminds me of a young Charles Woodson in terms of his versatility of what he can do as a pass rusher, as a run defender, and as a coverage player. And he can, he's not a great one-on-one coverage player like a cornerback, but he can give you enough there in addition to what he does, roaming the field and being able to, cut off routes. But he's just a fantastic intuitive athlete who just, You know, he can, it seems like he never stays on the ground very long. He can adjust his body and make adjustments in the middle of plays in the same way that Patrick Mahomes does as a thrower. He does as a tackler. It, you know, there's things that he does that you would think he's just about to get beat on an angle, and he somehow finds a way to make the play. And I just love the combination of athletic ability, intelligence, intuitive skills, versatility. And if there was, if someone said to me, you can only pick one player in this draft and that's going to be your draft, that's all you're going to get, I'm going to take Grant Delpit.
Perfect answer right at the buzzer. And I love the way you broke him down. He has been a fun player to watch. For me, the bulk of my work has still been the quarterback so far. And I still don't know who I'm going to pick with this answer, but the two guys that I've liked watching the most are Tua and Burrow. You know, I think when it comes to Burrow, look, I just love the leap that he's made. I mean, I wrote for the RSP this summer, like a piece on him and development and box score scouted, and had some questions that I wanted to see him answer. And he's answered them, I think. I think for the mental approach, he's answered them. I think from the, shall we say, onions approach, look, he's a gutty player. He takes some risks with the football, but they're appropriately aggressive decisions. And so I love what I've seen from Burrow, but I was watching some Tua this week. I hadn't really studied him yet this year. And I just love the way he plays the position. I love the understanding of footwork that we see from him. I love, and maybe it's just more noticeable because he's a left-handed quarterback, but to see him sort of fix his feet before some throws, to see him carry out run fakes to the opposite side and then snap the feet around and make a snap throw with a quick release like he does so often with velocity and good placement in the short area, I've loved watching that from him. Guys like Burrow and Herbert might be more schematically diverse, I think. I think Tua is more of a quick game, intermediate game type of quarterback right now. I'm not saying he can't run a downfield offense, but I think for a team that's looking to do that, he's going to be a great quarterback. So those two QBs I've loved watching so far.
Yeah, I love your answer so much so that that we took advantage of our current state of officials because they were manning the clock on this particular one.
They were too busy counting the 13 guys on the field to notice the play clock running down and stuff.
So that's what I love is that we can always point to the officials when we go over and we don't hit the buzzer.
It's not just us, you know? So
No.
But staying with the college game for a minute, Matt, going back to the wide receiver position now, getting a little more skill player friendly. Your favorite college wide receiver that you've seen so far?
And there are a lot of good ones in this class, you know, that people are talking about. But the one that I just watched last night for the first time in terms of really setting his game up close is one of the guys on Joe Burrow's team, and that's Justin Jefferson. I really dig this guy, and it's probably because I like guys who are in that Marvin Jones, Dante Pettis type of mold, or maybe intersect with a guy like Robert Woods, where they're versatile. They can play outside. They can play inside. They work well in the middle of the field, but they have the ability to adjust to the ball in the air. And those are all things that Justin Jefferson does well. He's someone that's willing to work inside towards the safety and hit that catch that zone window, that tight zone window throw. He also can win on the fade routes. He's someone that I show some release moves that I like. He has some burst to be able to get deep. He plays long. He's someone that also, I like that he does the dirty work. They routinely put him tight for their run sets. And when they run toss or they run plays where he has to crack block, he takes on linebackers and he does it with good technique and enough that when you can block an outside linebacker at Florida, that's enough for me to see that this is a guy that's going to get down and dirty and that he's going to be a versatile NFL receiver who's going to be productive in the pass game and help you out in the run game.
Tremendous answer there, Matt, with a couple of seconds to spare too. And again, getting ready for this one, it was Jefferson. It was his teammate Chase, who I've loved as well, watching him. And then this guy that I'm going to mention. And it, again, goes back to studying Tua. And it's Ruggs. And his speed is just, it's not from this planet. And we just got done, you know, 20 minutes ago, talking about Tyreek Hill and how he can change offenses and how you can build around him. And to see him catch a slant against South Carolina and just house it when everybody in the secondary basically has the angle on him, it blew my mind to see him catch that swing route to open the game, open the season against New Mexico State. And when all 10 defenders, other than the backside corner, have a shot at you, and it's not even a contest, this speed that he has is it's like Tyreek. And so some team is going to get him and can just do so much with him schematically that he's going to change the course of their offense overnight. And so for me, it's Ruggs. Yeah. He's
beautiful.
Just so fast, man. It's crazy. But let's go from speed to wisdom. Matt, what NFL quarterback do you think would be the best teacher?
I'm going to say Drew Brees. And I know that we haven't seen quarterbacks come out of New Orleans where, right, you know, that would support that, you know. And I think a lot of people, especially our community, would probably say, well, who's the, you know, they'd want to count it, you know, and they'd say, how many great quarterbacks or starting caliber quarterbacks have come out of a system where that quarterback was the starter? And my answer to that would, or my response to that would be, why are you using that as the barometer? Because really, that guy is trying to hang on to his job, and he's trying to, he's basically, you know, trying to do the best he can to make this game, you know, to be the best at his game as he is and hold off competition. So I would imagine him to be, want to be cutthroat. But if you put him in a position where you want him to be a teacher, I think Drew Brees, because he's so mechanically sound. He also started off on a team that was a very run oriented team in Marty Schottenheimer's offense. He worked with the likes of Doug Flutie, and had been benched off and on during his career. He'd been counted out and early on in his career. And then he's also been in a very successful offense in New Orleans. And I just think that his hyper accuracy, his footwork, his preparation, his mind for offenses, is the way that he adjusts. I think he's the type of player that can tier different quarterbacks based on their ability and help them get the best out of what their game is and expand it to an unlimited potential if he gets a quarterback of that type.
That's a very good answer and a very interesting one. We're going in – this is one of the reasons I love doing this show, is because we go in different directions sometimes, because you went with the Brees answer, which is why I wasn't anticipating, but I loved it. I'm going Josh McCown.
Ooh.
And the reason why I'm doing that is because we've seen evidence of it in a sense. You know, we saw it last year with Sam Darnold when Josh McCown knew that his role was to be – mentor. It was to be teacher in a sense. And so there's almost a body of work where we can rely on to point at Josh McCown and say, you saw the development from Sam Darnold as a rookie. You saw the way he's progressed to where now, yes, mono-free Sammy D looks good, but the foundation for that was laid last year. And I think Josh McCown had a big role in that. And I always flash back to the moment after his first game, Darnold's first game. They go on the road, he throws a pick six on his first NFL throw, but they come back and they beat Detroit. And after that game, to see Darnold's mom hug her son and then hug Josh McCown right after that. Yeah. You know, there's that sort of moment where you realize what this guy meant to the young rookie quarterback. And so we've got a body of work to rely on, so I'm going with Josh McCown.
Can we do the alternate answer and say, if we were to have a teacher be like an 80s movie, that the movie Real Genius with Val Kilmer, that that Jim McMahon could play the real, yes, genius Val Kilmer mentor, maybe? That's, that would be kind beautiful. Of fun. There we go.
I love that.
Okay.
That's our second show in a row with a Jim McMahon reference.
Hey, man, I got to get Jim McMahon in at least once a month. So
I need to see you down at Mobile with the Adidas headband on.
That says Pluto? Or, yeah. or Goodell. Now we need Goodell.
Yeah, we need a Goodell one because he had the, you know. Oh, gosh. Who was the commissioner then?
Roselle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Matt. Let's play Jerry Maguire for a moment. Give me your mission statement. Give me what is a common behavior among our Twitter analyst community that you would like to see change.
Complaints about bad football. I understand.
Do people remember what June's like? I mean, come on. Yeah,
exactly. And you want to watch bad football? You know what? Tune in on Saturday. If you want to compare Saturday and Sunday, you can compare those, or go somewhere on Friday and watch some football, you know, on Friday night somewhere. Because listen, this is, the professional level is way better than any of the others. There, you know, they may be more fun in certain things. You may see more demonstrations of great athletic ability in stark contrast to, you know, subpar athletic ability in the college game, which makes it more exciting. Mm-hmm. But if you're bored as an analyst by what's going on in football on, you know, that you're covering in the NFL, then I would argue that you're not studying the game enough, that you have more to learn about the game, and that, you know, what you're that you're being more of a movie reviewer than an actual analyst or student of the game. And, you know, I understand that there are times that there is bad play that occurs, but I'm just, you know, to me, it's just like the talk about it is so pervasive. And some of the time I'm watching the game and I'm like, I'm extremely interested in all of this. I don't see how you find this boring.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to look at it. And that's something that I would like to see change. But I'm going to go with Twitter just generally because I hate it. Okay. I despise it. And I think it has ruined all of us because all of us, and I'm as guilty of this as anybody else, we spend our time chasing clout. We just naturally have to do it. And it's partly because of the industry that we are in now where you have to do that. But, you know, when that All 22 comes out, I feel the urge that I got to get on and I got to start putting clips up there. Otherwise, you know, I'm not going to get the retweets. And so there's that element to Twitter, and there's the overreaction that happens every single week, every single play. Just this season, we have seen Daniel Jones go from the chosen one that enables people to rub their faces in his success because we doubted him, to now I don't think he's very good because he threw three picks against a historically good defense on a nationally televised game. And it turned in the blink of an eye. And so Twitter has ruined us all. I hate it. I wish I could delete the app, but I've got three Twitter tabs open right now as we record this show. So Twitter, it's ruined all of us. I hate it.
That should be their tagline, yeah, or their brand slogan.
Twitter has ruined you all, yeah, and we're proud of it.
Yeah.
Keep tweeting. There you go, Jack. I just did your ad budget for next year. So let's move away from Twitter to the world of crime and punishment. Matt's questions take an interesting turn here at the end of this one. We'll start with this. Matt, did you ever commit a crime as a kid?
Yes. Now, which one do you want me to answer?
Which one?
I'm going to give you a choice. Do you want to hear about the long running scam that I committed that probably would have got that got me busted as 11-year-old, or do you want to hear about me stowaway on a flight at 14?
Yeah, I see. I knew you were probably going to tell the stowaway story. I want to hear about the scam then. I want to hear what mischievous 11-year-old Matt Waldron was up to.
Okay, I just moved to Atlanta and was probably somewhat confused about a number of different things going on there and probably angry. So as a number of 11-year-old kids do who are, how would I put this, middle class white and privileged,
oh boy,
that you would probably not do if you're an African American kid, because you've had that talk by your parent and you know, but you know, I didn't have that kind of situation. So I thought my friends were shoplifting at the convenience store. I was kind of scared to do that. So I did something that turned out to be even worse, which was that instead of shoplifting, I saw that in the back of the store that they had all these empty glass bottles. And I thought, you know what? Well, why don't I just take those and then turn them in the next day and pocket the refund money for the recycling. And then I can just buy the stuff I want to get. So what I'd find myself doing over the span of about the next 6 weeks is I'd just steal the bottles out of the store in the back when they weren't looking, put them in a bag, and then come back every 3 days and make about, you know, $3 to $5 worth of money every few days. And for like several weeks, I was just buying whatever I wanted off of stealing their own things and turning it back into them until I got brazen enough to decide that I was going to shoplifting, and I wasn't very good as a thief, because when I did try to come back the next day, the manager of the shop came out and told me never to come back again over the fact that I was trying to steal a piece of gum, considering the fact that I probably like stole about, oh, I don't know, 50 to 100, probably about $50 to $60 worth of of recycling over the span beforehand. I actually kind of got away with a lot more than I thought, but try not to get caught shoplifting. I ended up in something much deeper.
Wow. That little cycle of crime there from a young Matt Waldman. Let's see. How do I want to handle this one?
Are your kids listening?
No, my kids, but my parents are. And it's probably worse. I mean, I'll just go with this one. When I was in sort of middle school, so that, I guess, what are you, 11, 12, 13 kind of range, 14 on the younger side. The bus route would take us over 128/I-95 in the suburban Boston area. And so we would go over this bridge, and you've got what, like six lanes, eight lanes of traffic below you. And let's just say that we had this habit of, shall we say, depositing the things we didn't want in our backpacks anymore out the window. And we would time it so they would obviously fly out of the bus as we were going over six lanes of traffic. Okay? Which is just an awful thing to think about now, years later, when I'm just like, these poor people are just like stuck in traffic trying to get home. And suddenly they have land on their windshield, some kid's like science textbook. And to make matters worse, just to tell you what a delinquent I was back in the day, and you know, probably still am, we had this running game of pranks amongst my group of friends where we would take bits of food, the more disgusting the better, and try to sneak them into somebody's textbook without them finding out. And so there would be situations where you would go to turn your textbook in back at the end of the year, or you would get to a chapter and you open the page and you're like, why is this sticking together? Because it's a 13-week-old slice of bologna that's been stuck there that's now like crusted over in your textbook. So imagine you're stuck in traffic. You see this bus go overhead. A textbook lands on your windshield and it's got like a 13-week-old crusted slice of bologna now sticking to your windshield.
Love it.
I'm an awful human being.
Love it.
Just an awful. Well, I ended up like a
what comes around goes around, I believe, because you can ask about my wife's car one day, and I can tell you about the time that we used to play skip the rocks across four lanes of traffic to see if we could hit hubcaps of 18 wheelers going the opposite direction. And what happens when you hit one of those hubcaps and it rebounds back into traffic and ruins the car.
See,
that was me at seven. So I was a bit of a handful. Oh. So we'll just put it that way.
Can't believe mom and dad. I'm sorry you had to hear that, but there you go. To cap off a life of crime, Matt, what would your death row meal be?
Yeah, like I think everyone has a like, what would your last meal be if you had to have a last meal? And mine's kind of simple. I think I'd want like a really hearty, like maybe it's not simple, but it's like a bolognese, you know, just like some pasta with a really hearty, like sweet, savory bolognese with some, homemade noodles. We have a place nearby where I live that makes homemade noodles, and it's just unbelievable. And so that was some garlic bread. And I'd be good to go, honestly, if I just had something that good, because my grandmother used to make a great spaghetti and great pasta, and I've always used that recipe. But just that's always been very satisfying. How about you?
I was going to say this anyway. I'm not saying this now to like butter up my mom and dad because, you know, they just heard me, you know, confess to a life of crime. But I'm going to go with, and now I'm going to make another faction of people angry, but I'm going to go with the way my mom made veal cutlets, like double breaded, thinly sliced, like deep fried. And you know,
you're
the way you do it.
Who cares?
Seriously. No, but I PETA people listening to the show are probably going to be angry at me right now. But look, veal, like I'm an Italian kid, you know, growing up in the Boston area, the way you would always do it, the way like my grandmother and then my mom did it was you get done frying them, you double bread them. And then, which is always odd to me, you pull out one of the paper shopping bags you got from the Stop and Shop that weekend, you throw it on the counter and you just take the fried cutlet and just let it like sort of sit on this like dirty paper bag from the grocery store to sort of drain out and blot out a little bit of the grease, which I still do to this day. And I'm like, let me find a clean one. It's like they've been sitting under the sink for months. They're not anywhere close to clean. And you're not cooking them again afterwards, but nope, you're going to shove it in your mouth. Like, what are you doing? But that's what I would have on death row.
It just makes it all the better.
Yeah, you know, get some of that grocery store grime on there. It's a little extra seasoning. So,
awesome.
Yeah, that would be my death row meal. Matt, scariest horror movie. You listed some choices: The Exorcist, Hereditary, The Ring, Jaws, Woody Allen movies.
That 60 Minutes interview. Yeah. I would say that was pretty scary. That's funny to say,
but your scariest horror movie with Halloween approaching.
I would say, you know, I used to say Jaws because that one really, I saw it when I was young. So that probably had the biggest impact on me in both a positive way and a negative way initially. But I would say Hereditary is pretty darn creepy. And the more I've watched that recent film, I think that it is probably one of the creepiest movies that I have seen. It's subtler than The Exorcist, which is kind of like you just kind of getting, you know, hit by Ronnie Lott. Hereditary is kind of more like the looming presence of Lawrence Taylor off the edge over and over and over again. Yeah. So I'm going to say Hereditary.
I'm going to take a half a time out here because I know I'm probably going to run a little long with this answer. And at the outset, I wanted to say Jaws. Because, you know, in my relationship with my wife, like we watch diametrically different stuff. Like I obviously loved Game of Thrones and like just so engrossed myself into that world, read all the books, all of that stuff. And my wife is like, how can you watch it? It's so disgusting. It's violent. It's brutal. Like, how can you watch it? I'm like, because it's fantasy. It's not going to happen. And then my wife will sit down and watch all these like true crime things. And I'm like, how can you watch this? Like she was watching some show, some like British show, Luther. And it's a scene where there's this couple in bed and they hear a noise in the attic and the husband goes to check it out. And there's some random creepy guy there that like leaps out from a mannequin and like stabs the guy to death. And she has to hear him like, okay, nobody's getting beheaded. Ned Stark isn't going to get hung up on charges anytime soon. But what you just watched could literally happen tonight. Okay. So anything that sort of has a real world element freaks me out, kind of like Jaws. But to now that I've just destroyed my wife on the air, I'll come back and make fun of my parents a little bit more because for me, it's Halloween, the original Halloween.
Oh.
Why? Because when I was growing up and I was like 8, 9 or so, my parents let me watch it on a Halloween night. And I have not been the same since. And that music, that piano chord, I'm just imagining that song and I'm getting chills up my spine. That music to this day terrifies me. It could be the middle of July. I could be in a field surrounded by nothingness and my phone could somehow play that and I would crawl into a fetal position immediately. That movie just terrified me to this day. It's the scariest thing I've seen.
That's awesome. Yeah. That is awesome. So we did get at least a couple listener questions about they wanted to ask a non-football question. And let's end it with that. I can't seem to find the list, though.
I've Do you remember? I've got a couple that I could throw out. And what was great was we got, of course, some total references. Brian Zulowski, who is at FLOES420, asked Total or Steely Dan. We had Daniel Simpkins, who is X Fantasy Phoenix. You are headed to the Serengeti to do some sightseeing. As you make your way there with your guide, your vehicle breaks down in a remote area with no cell phone reception. Name one thing you wish you had to help you get out of this jam. So you get some total references there. But I'm going to go with this question, Matt. It's from Scott Freeland at Freeland26. Name a formative moment from your childhood that you've come to realize played a role in shaping who you are. And I probably just listed like 5 on my part, but for you, Matt.
Name a formative role.
A formative moment from your childhood that you've come to realize played a role in shaping who you are.
Boy. Mine's not going to be a very, very positive one, but I will say that it did, that it was probably the most impactful. And I've probably talked about this before, so I hate to end it on this note, but I can't think of anything without telling the truth about it. So I had to prevent a parent from being a victim of domestic violence when I was 11 years old, which is probably why I was acting out the way that I was. Right. So let's just put it that way. And so the person was much bigger than I was. And the person left the house before any violence. Well, violence ensued, but before the violence became really, really impactful physically on my parent. And it was a very surreal moment for me, and it felt like a dream, and it was something that took a while for me to work through as an adult. And it probably led to me having to, for me to get counseling as a young man so that I could understand and come to grips with things in my life that allowed me to have a healthy emotional life. And I was very fortunate. I'm glad that happened in the sense that it did, because the moment happened in the sense it did, because it did help me mature very quickly, maybe too quickly, but I needed to mature that quickly as a child, unfortunately. But it was something that, you know, and I had a lot of wonderful moments in my childhood, but, you know, this was obviously not one of them, and it did have a huge impact in negative ways. But I would say that it also helped me become self-reliant, helped me understand some things about how to deal with people. And then also, you know, was kind of a coping moment in my childhood, so that when later on that I was able to get some help. And I would definitely recommend anybody who is coping with any type of issues, whether it's learning how to be angry, learning how to be angry appropriately, anything of that nature, any dysfunctional behavior that you're starting to look around and go, you know what? I don't act like everyone else when it comes to these types of things. Or I don't act healthy. That's a better way to put it. I would definitely recommend seeking any type of mental health assistance. There's still stigma with that, but it's gotten less and less. And I would say it was a moment like that that allowed me to see that being able to look at my life critically as even a young man or a child or a young adolescent helped me understand that, regardless of the surrounding environment and people in your environment, that you can take action into your own hands in a positive way too, and do things to make your life better. And while that seems odd to say that event did that, in a way it did, and it translated later so that, you know, 10, 12 years later, you know, going into a therapist's office and to be able to have conversations and kind of unknot my life in ways that allowed me to move in the direction where that I could have good relationships with people, you know, and have loving, intimate relationships. It was a big formative thing in my life. So, that's probably a lot more information than I planned on sharing, but it's the truth. Yeah, so.
Very powerful answer, Matt. And I'm glad you did share that. And I'm going to go sort of in a similar realm. When I was 10, my family, we adopted my brother, who was 8 at the time. And he had been from an abusive background, and he had been in and out of foster homes and in and out of, you know, homes for, you know, children without, you know, parents, or had to be taken away from homes. And it was obviously a huge change in my life as, you know, an only child for about 9, almost 10 years. And now suddenly I have a peer, not just a baby brother, like an actual peer. You know, it was, you know, turbulent at times, and it continues to be to this day a little bit turbulent. But you know, what really sort of out of the many things that came out of this was, like you said, therapy. Because as part of the process, we had to do some family therapy because, you know, people wanted the, you know, state boards that helped place, you know, my brother with our family wanted to make sure that the transition was going well. And so there were family therapy sessions. There were individual therapy sessions for me. And I never really took it seriously at the time because, look, I'm 10, 11, 12 when this is happening. You don't really take it seriously. But later in life, when I was – and I've been honest and open about my sort of transition from lawyer to football writer and how my anxiety and my depression and all the things I was struggling with as a 35, 38-year-old lawyer were really sort of taking hold and really sending me down a dark path. It was that background of being in a therapist's office that made it a little bit more okay in my mind, a little bit more familiar for me to then do it as a 35, 36, 37 year old man that realized that he needed some help. It was like, I've done this before. Maybe I didn't take it seriously then because it didn't really seem like I needed it then, but I need it now. And it's okay to walk into that office. It's okay to sort of take that first step. And, you know, therapy and yes, the career change, certainly I'd be completely honest, probably saved my life or at least extended it because I was headed down an extremely dark road and it was not going to end well for me. And maybe in a sense sort of ensured that my marriage would continue and I'd still get to be a dad to my, you know, son and daughter, because again, I was an awful person to be around during that time. And so that event, obviously adopting, being part of an adopting family, certainly formative, but it was that process of therapy that I think enabled me to do it later in life in a way that I probably wasn't even cognizant of, you know, even thinking about it now, I'm probably more cognizant of it than back then. It just made it an easier thing to do. So I'd point to my brother's adoption and that aftermath as probably a big event in my past.
Well, we're certainly all glad that you're, you know, that you are where you are and doing what you're doing, because, you know, this, having a, doing a show like this is with you is absolutely awesome. So, you know, to answer one of the questions that I remember is, what do you hate the most about your co-host is that we have to end this show.
Exactly.
That's probably what I hate the most about this, is that I know that I'm not going to have enough time getting to chat up Mark and talk about different things. So on this note, and speaking of family, I'd like to wish my wife a happy 10th anniversary. Usually we don't remember the day it was. We were supposed to get married on the 17th. We ended up married on the 16th. That's how life goes. And you know, it's been an awesome journey, Alicia, with you. And I am, you know, I know that, you know, it's totally subjective, but I you can fight me to the death that I am the luckiest human being on earth to be married to you. So, you know, on that note, on behalf of Mark and I, thank you again for listening to the quick game, which obviously is not quick in terms of what we've done today. But we enjoyed covering a lot of ground, and you can listen to us at the Matt Waldman RSP cast. You can find Mark at Mark Schofield on Twitter, which he hates. Find me at Matt Waldman on Twitter, which I barely tolerate. And we, and we still love doing it anyhow. It's a great gig, and you can find our work at the site, mattwaldmanrsp.com. You guys have an awesome week.